Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Alex O'Meara had struggled with his type 1 diabetes all of his life. Initially reluctant, he joined a clinical trial in hopes of finally curing it. That experience prompted the journalist to take a closer look at the growing industry of medical trials. His new book is titled Chasing Medical Miracles, and Alex joins me in the studio. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you, Susan. It's good to be here.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org, or send us a tweet. Now, tell us about the clinical trial that you were part of. How did you hear about it?
I heard about it. I was living in Richmond, Virginia, and I had an insulin pump, and the pump malfunctioned, so the person from the company who came to fix it or look at it told me about this trial, and I dismissed it out of hand because I had had diabetes for almost 30 years and heard a lot about cures, and a cure for me really wasn't something I was seeking. I was just kind of satisfied with my type 1 diabetes, and that's the way it was going to be, and I wasn't tilting it, looking for anything else.
And so, what changed your mind then?
What changed my mind was my wife said, you really ought to give it a shot. You really ought to try. So I said, oh, all right, I'll try. So I went through the screening process and got all the tests, and lo and behold, I was a perfect match for who they were looking for, in that I had no diabetic complications except that I had a condition called hypoglycemic unawareness, which means my sugar would go low and I would go into comas, and I've been in a dozen or more comas, you know.
Now, eventually you became quite intent on being able to participate in this trial. What kinds of things did you have to do in order to make that happen?
Boy, what kinds of things did I have to do? Well, like I said, I went through a rigorous screening process, and in the course of that screening process, they found, for instance, this is one thing, they found a lump in my lung, and because going through the trial meant I would be on immunosuppression, they didn't know what the lump was. And they said, you know, it's probably not cancerous, but it might be something else. So you really ought to get it checked out. And so what I opted to do instead of just getting it checked out was to get a lobe of my lung removed so that it was gone, so that I would not be disqualified from the trial and take care of it. A friend of mine at the time said that was a little extreme. And I told them two things. I said, first of all, clinical trials are like the extreme sports of medicine, so that kind of goes with the property. And the other was that to cure diabetes, for a chance to cure diabetes, basically for myself, I was very selfish about it, I would light my hair on fire every day. You know, I mean, it gets so bad, you just have to take steps against something that seem extreme.
We're going to talk more later in this hour about the results that you had, but let's talk first about your investigation of this industry. Now, you decided because of your own experience there to take a closer look at what was happening. Tell us what you found.
But what I found, what piqued my interest, was that 20 million Americans are enrolled in clinical trials. That's not yearly. That's altogether over the years. I also found out that 50 million people are enrolled worldwide. Those are enormous numbers for something that I hadn't heard that much about, really. Then I found out it was a $24 billion a year industry. On top of that, I found out that it had grown about 300% in the last 10 years. So it struck me not just as a medical story or a small thing. It struck me as something closer to a cultural phenomenon. And I wanted to know how that was happening, how that came to be, and where that was leading us in medicine in general.
And that great explosion of participation has happened without a lot of publicity. I mean, occasionally one clinical trial will get some attention because it goes awry. But basically, there hasn't been a lot of attention paid.
There hasn't, partly because clinical trials, no one's in charge of clinical trials. There's no office of clinical trials. There's no czar. It's not, no one's driving the ship, basically. So you've got private industry doing their thing, which they don't want, frankly, a lot of attention for. They're also a very young industry that's grown up, so they're not organized to present themselves to the public. Clinical trials have a freakish sort of stigma a little bit, like, you know, Frankenstein cooking something up in his lab or whatever. So it's all happened organically in a lot of different places all at once. Oddly enough, no one's controlled it. And so it hasn't presented itself as a topic the way a lot of other things do.
Now, there are different kinds of clinical trials designed to do different things. Talk about some of the different kinds of trials.
Well, there's basic clinical trials. I mean, there's phase one clinical trials, and there's phases in trials, and they're to do anything. They can be anything to cure diabetes or to, you know, compare aspirin to ibuprofen and which one works better, or find cures for other things. Now, we're right now involved with the swine flu vaccinations, which just started in clinical trials, that they're going to push through in the next 2 months with 2,400 volunteers at 8 sites. This is a real big push to get a cure or a vaccine for swine flu because there's an outbreak. And because of that, a lot of people are volunteering for it. So this is the kind of thing you hear about. It happened with the polio vaccine in 1954. 1.8 million children were vaccinated in a very short period of time. So we can do this. We marshal these forces. But usually they're private enterprise or startup businesses that are looking to develop a treatment, a drug, or a device that will then be marketed.
And then, but before they can get it marketed, before they can get FDA approval, they must go through a trial process.
They must go through a trial process, or several trial processes, or several trials. That doesn't mean that there's a strange thing about trials. People think, well, you run these tests and then they reveal the results. They don't. There's no law or rule that says you have to reveal the results. And oddly enough, you can, let's say, I want to make a pill that will make everyone taller. Okay, this is my great idea. So I go out and I test it through 10 clinical trials. And 8 of those trials show that people don't get taller. But 2 of them show that people do get taller. Well, I can put the 8 that show they don't get taller in a drawer. No one has to know about those. And I can just tell people about the 2 if I want to. So the amount of clinical trials being done and the amount that are revealed are not exactly synced up.
Well, that seems to lead to the possibility of a lot of abuses in cases like we saw with Vioxx, a drug that came out for the treatment of the pain of arthritis. And then years later, we discover it's associated with heart attacks and strokes, and they pulled it off the market.
And it wasn't that it was discovered that it was. It wasn't discovered years later that it was. It was a re-examination of the data that had been collected in original trials and then another one that was started after it was marketed by other people to see if there was a link, and it turned out there was a significant link to heart attack.
Well, shouldn't the FDA require the release of all the data from all the clinical trials that are done if they're going to judge if a drug is safe or not?
It would, you know, it's going to seem that way. But the problem with that is you can regulate anything you want if you don't have the people to do anything, you know, about those regulations. For instance, the FDA, and I'm not anti-FDA or pro anything, but the FDA physically inspects 1% of all clinical trials. That's woefully inadequate. Now, part of that is, the reason for that is, it's grown so much. It is exploded to such an extent that it's hard to have the manpower to do it. And it's also exploded not just of people doing clinical trials, but private enterprise doing clinical trials. There are a lot of safeguards for businesses and corporate interests in America to do what they want, trade secrets and other legal things that prevent government intrusion, especially the last 10 years, which has been a very anti-regulatory time. So again, there's no nefarious thing going on. It just has grown that way in the time that it has grown.
Our phone lines are open. You can give us a call at 1-800-433-8850 with your questions or comments, or send us an email or tweet us on Twitter. There's another kind of clinical trial that would be a compassionate use trial. What is that designed to do?
Compassionate use trial would be, I'm not sure I understand.
Well, these would be to let people who have terminal illnesses get drugs that haven't yet been approved by the FDA.
Yes, there's a bill in the House of Representatives that was just passed where for cystic fibrosis, people with cystic fibrosis who have rare diseases who can take part in clinical trials and not lose their government health benefits. And that seems like a great idea. But with clinical trials, you don't know what's going to happen. So you think, oh, I have this terrible disease. I'm going to be harmed anyway, just like with diabetes with me was kind of my feeling, you know. That's not necessarily true, because when you allow subjects to dictate the terms of clinical trials, the tail starts wagging the dog. So the implications for that for medical research are very weird, frankly, and we've never been down that road because it hasn't functioned like that. There was a clinical trial where people had holes drilled in their heads and devices implanted to control Parkinson's, And it seemed to work for a while for these 24 patients enrolled in this trial. Then the company that sponsored it stopped the trial because they said it's dangerous. Now, that's rare that a company would do that. They said it was dangerous. The subjects sued to continue the trial because they wanted it because it improved things. Now, that is utterly backward of how we normally do research and utterly backward for what the understanding of what it means to enroll in a clinical trial is. But that is how it seems to go sometimes now.
And what happened in that Parkinson's case where the trial subjects felt it was helping them, the company felt it was just too dangerous?
It's still in litigation. It has not been solved, but it if it is solved for the subjects, that's a bad omen, I think, because clinical trials are not medical treatment. They are experimentation. You might get treated. I got treated. Other people do. But the point is never, ever treatment. And that's very strange right now because the number of clinical trials people are going up since the recession because people are seeking health care because they've lost their insurance and their jobs. It's a new phenomenon. And it's also very frightening because they're thinking of it as treatment and their doctors are recommending trials as treatment.
Now, why do all these Americans who have signed up for trials, some of them have diseases like Parkinson's and they're seeking relief, but a lot of them are healthy Americans who are willing to sign up for medical trials. Why do they do it?
They do it to make money. It's not a very wonderful living, I would say, but they do it. There's a wonderful website called justanotherlabrat.org that you can go to and learn all about it. And it seems freakish and weird. You know, I went up and did this myself, volunteered for a trial. Didn't go through with it, but I was going to be paid $800 to test an epilepsy medication at a commercial clinical trial in Phoenix. So I go up and I go through the screening and they have to take blood to see if you're on caffeine or nicotine or you drink or whatever. At the time I was on all kinds of drugs for my transplant, which I received, but I was also on Vicodin and antibiotics for a toothache I had. I mean, I was on more drugs than Elvis at the time and they passed me. They let me into the trial. So, you know, people who do it for money and companies that do it for money are otherwise motivated than for pure research.
We're talking to Alex O'Meara about his new book, Chasing Medical Miracles, The Promise and Perils of Clinical Trials. When we come back, we'll talk about what results he found from the clinical trial he went into to treat his diabetes. And we'll take your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio, Alex O'Meara. He's a freelance journalist who now lives in Arizona. He's the author of Chasing Medical Miracles, The Promise and Perils of Clinical Trials. So the clinical trial that you went into for your type 1 diabetes, what was it that they were doing?
What they were doing was they were taking islet cells or part of the pancreas that make insulin in their cells. And they would take, the plan was to take islet cells from cadaver pancreases and infuse them into my liver, where the cells would then hang out and make insulin for me.
And so you underwent this procedure?
Yes, I did. I took, I underwent it and then was on immunosuppression as though I had an organ transplant, same kind of thing. Went through very intense blood testing and screening right after in the weeks and 3 months after, twice a week of taking blood, once a week of getting IV immunosuppression, all this other very intense, very intense testing and heavy immunosuppression. And then I got a second transplant at the end of 3 months where they were supposed to tail off all that intense stuff. So they started all the intense stuff again. So it was 6 months of intense stuff. And at the end of 6 months, I had had two transplants.
And you had to be matched with your donor in the same way as if you were getting a kidney or something else, some other organ. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it works the same way.
And did it cure your diabetes?
Yes, it did. It took a while, but the cells came around and did their thing, and lo and behold, I was cured. Or as I like to say, I was insulin independent. I don't think cure is a word they like to throw around too much. But yes, it worked for a while.
And then what happened?
Then what happened was over time, the cells started to die, and this is happening with a lot of people who've had this, and only about 500 people in the world have had it done. And they don't know whether it's because of the immunosuppression or what the reason is, but the cells started to die. And I am now on about half the amount of insulin I was beforehand, but I no longer have the condition of hypoglycemic unawareness, so I'm not, you know, every other day falling into a coma, which is kind of nice.
Was it worth it?
Yeah. Well, yes. You know, it's worth it from the sense of having the ability when you have a chronic condition your whole life to, as I say, go on offense rather than always play defense. And if someone gives you the opportunity in a situation like that to do something, it takes a kind of person to really want to try and really be dedicated to it and to know that it is an attempt, it's not a guarantee. Again, it's not treatment. To not have done it would have left more questions for me, I think, as time went on. So for me, it was worth it, but it was a very carefully weighed decision, and it was very well researched to make that decision.
It cost you money and time. You had to endure a lot of heavy-duty medical testing. There were some personal costs, too, including your marriage.
Yes. My wife, who had convinced me to go into this trial about 8 months afterward, very suddenly left me because the stress from the trial and the situation freaked her out, basically. And literally one day, she just left. Because she couldn't take it anymore.
And would you do this again if there was another treatment that seemed very promising for diabetes? Would you undergo another clinical trial?
I'm going to say yes. Yeah, I think I would for the reason that, you know, as time went on with my own clinical trial, I evolved in my own outlook to think that, wow, I really was helping other people. And I know that sounds kind of sappy, but I did evolve to that point, and I did help other people as well as myself. And there is something rewarding about that that I can't quite describe. That was a nice benefit as well.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll talk first to Lisa. She's calling us from St. Louis. Lisa, hi. Thanks for giving us a call.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you so much for bringing up this topic. I work in the industry of clinical research, and it's so important that former subjects or patients get out there and explain that, you know, I mean, so many people that I talk to in just the general population look at this as being guinea pigs and things of that nature, and it's definitely not that. I really appreciate the fact that he mentioned the fact that you're doing this not only for yourself but for other people as well. I work in cancer research, and so I help monitor sites that actually perform the research and make sure that they're following all the FDA guidelines and that the sites themselves do things appropriately according to the trial that's out there for cancer research. And it's just so important that people realize that there are choices out there and that they can, many times trials will compare a standard of care treatment to something that's standard of care plus something else, and how important these different clinical trials out there are for us finding all the new treatments and hopefully cures in the future.
Lisa, you work in this field. Do you feel like that the level of supervision and regulation is high enough to make sure there aren't abuses or problems with these clinical trials?
I do. I deal with the regulations every day. The regulations have improved over time. I know about I don't know the exact dates, but I know back in the late 90s, there was a breast cancer trial that happened in another country that the physician apparently had made up all of the patients and put that data forward, and then that ended up being false data. But I know in the United States we have excellent regulation, and the company that I work for is an international company, and they, all over the world, they ensure that they're the people that are participate, the physicians and the principal investigators that are participating in their trials are following the good clinical practices and the international, the ICH guidelines, which are a set of guidelines that were developed for all clinical trials way back, starting after the whole things that were going on in Germany where they were testing people without their consent and that sort of thing. So,
okay, Lisa. Thank you so much for your call. Alex?
I do agree. In the U.S., we have actually wonderful care. There are some big loopholes in regulations, not in the regulations themselves, but in how they're applied and what can be done. Regarding overseas, I said 50 million people in the world are enrolled in clinical trials. Western companies, by that I mean European and American, generally companies who do clinical trials, who conduct them, are leaving for undeveloped countries in droves. They can do regulation. They can do clinical trials much cheaper, faster. The most surprising thing of that you'll find is the FDA has a regulation. Let's say a company wants to go to another country and they're from America. They only have to adhere to either the Helsinki guidelines, which are pretty broad, or to the regulations of the host country. This is where it gets interesting, because most countries, underdeveloped countries, have no regulations. So you can adhere to the letter of the law and go to another country and not really have to do very much. And that's where it gets slippery. Now, other countries that are underdeveloped are seeking clinical trials, India, Eastern Bloc countries, China, because they think, and it's somewhat true, that these companies bring medical care and drugs that they otherwise would not have. So it's a very weird situation right now where we think we're getting the same regulations imposed because they're American companies, but in fact we're not.
Can an American drug maker who has to conduct trials to get FDA approval choose to do those any place in the world and then bring those results back for the FDA?
Absolutely. All they have to do is bring the data after it's been crunched. Now, and they're aware of the fact that they can have easier entree and that there are fewer regulations overseas. I was in Uganda speaking to the guy who was at the Sambia Hospital, who's a director of an AIDS clinic. He has 12,000 patients on a budget of $250,000 a year. And he told me, I would welcome a clinical trial in a heartbeat, because he runs out of medication for his patients. And for him, he doesn't want an unethical trial. That's not what they're saying. But they want anything that they can get their hands on. And companies are willing to give that to people who have nothing.
Now, we've got several emails from people who would like to hear you talk about the difference between clinical trials that might take place at a university and those that take place by for-profit enterprises like drug makers. Are they different?
They might be different. There is universities in recent years have moved to a more business-based model because CROs, clinical research organizations, were stealing business away from them. Now, when companies tried to get their drugs tested, universities would drag their feet. They would be academic institutions, which aren't the most efficient animals in the world. And so they said, we can do this better on our own. And they did, and they started to. And so now 70% of clinical trials are performed by private enterprise. That's not necessarily good. It's not necessarily bad. There's never been a comparison, a head-to-head comparison of the results of both. So, but you have to understand that the motivation for companies is money, and the motivation for research institutions used to be pure research, but now it's mixed in with money too, because they have to make money.
And are the rules the same regulating the trials, regardless of whether they take place at a university or for a private drug maker?
Yes, the regulations are the regulations, but companies can hide. Right now, the Obama administration has introduced legislation to have more transparency of clinical trials results through the FDA. They're doing this by asking for a relaxation of trade secrets regulations, because companies, when they say they're not going to release results of clinical trials because they are trade secrets. Research institutions typically don't do that. So being an American business corporation, corporate entity, you have business safeguards that are built into the medical process that are not there for research institutions all the time. Sometimes they are. So that poses a unique set of problems.
Let's go to Jan calling us from San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I'm involved in diabetes type 2 research, actually, and I see a lot of people that we call professional patients, and some just do it every year to get, like, their yearly workups for free if they don't have insurance or something. But I was wondering if in your research, your 20 million statistic, if you found out whether or not some of those were repeat patients or not. I wanted to know, like, how big this professional patient pool was.
And, Jan, do you prefer these professional patients because they know what they're signing up for, or do you find them maybe less valuable than someone who's just doing it as a one-shot thing?
Not necessarily at all. It really doesn't make a difference. A lot of the people in diabetes research are repeat patients maybe because they're just trying to get their medications for free. I mean, they get a lot of treatment for free, and what I do isn't really that experimental. It's just finding different combinations of drugs.
All right, Jen, thanks very much for your call.
The motivation for that is clear because, you know, a bottle of insulin costs about, I don't know, $75-$80. And if you don't have insurance and you need to take two vials of insulin plus syringes plus test your blood, I mean, it just goes on and on and on for a chronic condition for all of your life. So people who do that are kind of ginning the system, but the system has been made in such a way that they're able to do that. So it's a chicken and egg kind of thing. You can't really blame them for availing themselves of whatever is out there. And also, companies are going to enroll people even if they sort of know, you know, just like they sort of knew that I didn't pass my blood test perhaps in the clinical trial that I enrolled for. But this is the way it works because trials, like medicine, have become so commodified on both sides, both for subjects and those sponsoring them.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850 and reading your emails at drshow@wamu.org. Well, have there been cases where people who signed up for clinical trials have catastrophic results for themselves?
Yeah, there have been some. There's one in particular, Jesse Gelsinger, an 18-year-old from Tucson, Arizona, near where I live, as a matter of fact. I interviewed his father, Paul Gelsinger, great man. His son signed up for a clinical trial that would not have benefited him. It would have perhaps benefited other people. It was for gene therapy for a condition he had which affected the protein in his bloodstream. During that clinical trial, Jesse died. And it turned out afterward that some of the investigators and sponsors of the trial had misled the Gelsingers into signing up. One individual had an apparent conflict of interest because he had a financial stake in a company that was developing the therapy. So again, there's that hybrid of private and public going on all over the place. And this is at a major university, the University of Pennsylvania. So, and that was catastrophic for a great many reasons, mostly for the loss of a person, of course. But afterward, when the Gelsingers brought suit, there was a civil settlement, and they settled in a couple of weeks, which is a land speed record for any kind of lawsuit to be settled ever. The reason for that is they didn't want any attention paid to this, of course, or not very much. And it pointed out something about the legal system because Paul Gelsinger wanted to push harder and go further. And his lawyer at the time, Alan Milstein, who's very good at clinical trials and is kind of forging ahead of other people, found that clinical trials cases are heard usually under medical malpractice standards. But clinical trials are not medicine. They're experimentation. So there's this gray area, and you can't really get a grip on them to bring litigation unless it's civil litigation, and the pockets of either researchers or those sponsoring the clinical trials are extremely deep. So you've got this bad situation that pushes against the possibility of either punishment and bringing about regulation because of that, or bringing attention through criminality or other things that would draw attention to a case like that.
Well, in this terrible case with the death of this young man, were there consequences for the investigators or for the University of Pennsylvania?
The consequences were that the investigators, the sponsors, some of them were put on They were not allowed to conduct clinical trials for a number of years. I think it was 3 years. But that's it. That was all. And then they went back to doing what they did, and I think they had to get some retraining as well. Paul Gelsinger said all he wanted out of this, and apparently he got a sum of money, but all he really wanted was he wanted the documents that they covered up, and he wanted an admittance and apology. He did not get either, and he will not get either. And that's the unfortunate thing, because cases like this escape public attention not because they're obscure, but because they're – and they're not they're covered up, but there's – they don't get traction in the public consciousness because they're not allowed to, because these kinds of things happen.
We should say also that there have been some big advances very useful to people through clinical trials. What are some of the success stories from clinical trials?
Clinical trials are, you know, heart stents. The pediatric cancer has been cut from 80% mortality to about 20% these days. Clinical trials, 99.9% of them are successful and above board and great and wonderful. The Wall Street Journal, when they reviewed Chasing Medical Miracles, said it's not an expose, it's more of a worried portrait. And I would have to agree with that. I think that's absolutely true. There is potential out there. That's the thing. There is potential for things to go one way or the other because there's no one at the helm, because it's so diffuse, and because it's grown up so quickly. And this is something that people should be aware of, especially as they're enrolling in greater numbers and it's affecting them personally.
We're talking to Alex O'Meara. He's written a new book called Chasing Medical Miracles, The Promise and Perils of Clinical Trials. We're going to take another very short break, and when we come back, we'll go back to the phones and take your calls and questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, death barges in. We talk with poet Kathleen Sheeter Bonanno. Her new collection of poems is about the murder of her daughter. Fellow poet Sharon Olds describes the work as a gift of power, truth, rage, and beauty. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking this hour about a book called Chasing Medical Miracles. The author, Alex O'Meara, is in the studio with me. Our first caller we're going to take now is John Lewis. He's a vice president of public affairs for the Association of Clinical Research Organizations. John Lewis, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Susan. Thank you. Hi, Alex.
Hi, John.
And now you had something. You had a comment you wanted to make.
Well, had a few comments or clarifications on some comments that Alex made. And first of all, Alex, thank you for raising the issue of clinical trial participation. I think we all agree that more participants are needed, and you've pointed out many of the benefits, including your personal benefits, and I think you said you'd participate in another clinical trial, which is great to hear. Just a few points, though. When you said that no one controls clinical trials, you know, I think the FDA has a lot of oversight of clinical trials and certainly approves clinical trials. Whether the FDA has enough resources dedicated to that oversight is another matter, and we support more resources. So I just wanted to be clear that there is regulation of clinical trials, and there is more regulation globally of clinical trials, both from the FDA and from host countries in places like India and China and elsewhere, and we just released a white paper on that last week. Also, regarding the academic versus commercial research, there actually are different standards. Commercial research is under a higher standard, and there is legislation that has been introduced in the House by Representative DeGette from Colorado that would harmonize this regulation, and we support that.
That's good to hear. Yeah.
Putting all patients under a higher standard. Last of all, just on the point of research participants being motivated by money, that may be true in some phase one trials where you're testing first in human drugs, and we've certainly seen some incidents of that. But certainly in the later phases, the people in the clinical trials actually have the conditions that the drugs are being tested for, and money is not a motivation there. I think you would agree with that.
I absolutely agree with that. I think we're referring to people who refer to themselves as guinea pigs and do guinea pigging for money.
Yeah, and obviously we don't like that term. We don't encourage that. But realistically, I mean, you do need participants in that phase to test the safety of the drug. So,
absolutely.
So I just wanted to make those points and like your book and appreciate your comments, but wanted to go on the record with some clarification.
Okay, John Lewis, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Warren, Michigan, and talk to another John. John, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I was going to the University of Michigan. I was HIV. I'm HIV positive, and I was approached by Pfizer. One of the people from Pfizer. It's a very unusual situation. I was down to one of my last regimens, or I thought I was, but I'm never that negative about it. And I was. They brought this woman into the room. They said I was the perfect candidate. For a trial, you know, but I have reservations about that anyway. And I asked, I said, I was hoping they could meet me halfway because I'm living on Social Security because of my condition and because of my my employment situation. I talked to this, or I asked this person several questions, but one of the questions I asked is, I'm coming from the Detroit area, which is 40 miles from Ann Arbor, and if I was going to be in one of these trials, would they pay for my gas money? And I was going in circles with this person. I felt like I was dealing with a used car salesman. It was the strangest situation. It really left me uneasy, and it left me uneasy about the hospital because Pfizer was parked right next door to it. My mind started going about it. Well, I never got in the trial, and then shortly after that, Pfizer is, you know, moved out of Ann Arbor. So, you know, I don't know what to think about them. I think it's a very, very slippery slope, and it left me with a really bad taste in my mouth about clinical trials.
Well, John, thanks so much for sharing your experiences. Well, Alex O'Meara, you talk about what people who are thinking about joining a clinical trial ought to do before they go ahead. What do you think they should do?
There's a couple of things in general. There's specific things that you can read in my book about what you should do if you really are thinking about it. But generally, here's the first thing that you should do is to realize that it is not treatment. Clinical trials are not treatment. You may receive treatment, but that's not the point. And set yourself up in your head. Put yourself in a position to realize that you may not be treated at all. You may not get any therapeutic benefit, and you may even be harmed. That's what the consent process is about. That's what it's all about, is your agreement, your full agreement. Now, I think we all know that intellectually in a lot of ways, but in the book I describe it as, you know, when we're on our way to Disneyland and we're on the plane and they're describing what to do if the plane starts crashing and, you know, here's what you do, here are the exits, and you're not really thinking about that because you're busy thinking about shaking hands with Goofy, you know? But you really have to think about it in this instance because it really is a possibility. So put yourself in that position of being someone who is not talking to a doctor but a researcher, and that is the role they're playing. And if you look at it from that mindset, you stand a much better chance of being able to be more critical and scrutinize it for your own benefit and to hold the researchers more accountable, which, frankly, most researchers, I would say, would want to be. They would want to have these questions asked. They would want to have rigorous input from subjects and others so that they can get the best possible results.
Well, John's experience about trying to get gas money if he was going to be driving back and forth to Ann Arbor, is that something that you should expect? Should you expect the people running the clinical trial to cover expenses that are going to come up for you?
It would depend on what they were offering. A lot of clinical trials, even if they're done through universities and so forth, have some relationship to private enterprise. However, that doesn't mean that there is money available for your participation or that it is a way of making financial gain for yourself. That's an important consideration. John Lewis was correct in saying that phase one trials, these are healthy individuals where they test drugs to see what the levels are before they can be applied to people who have the condition. And those people do it, frankly, for money. I mean, they'll come out and say, you're going to get, they told me, you'll get $800 for 4 days of taking an epilepsy drug. Woohoo, okay. You know, but when I got the diabetes thing, it wasn't, I didn't expect that. I had did not have that expectation. They were going to pay for my meds, some of them. They were going to pay for follow-up, but they told me exactly what they could cover and what they might not cover, and I knew that going in. If there's any kind of dickering over that or negotiation, it's probably not the most savory situation for either the subject or the researcher because you're negotiating over something that might really shouldn't be on the table when it's pure research.
Let's talk to Kathleen. She's calling us from here in Washington, D.C. Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Susan. This is Kathleen Reed. How are you doing?
Good.
Good. Let me – I serve – on an institutional review board for the NIH. And I wanted to clarify, just like John Lewis, I wanted to clarify a few things. There's a term that is used for what Mr. O'Meara went through, and that's called therapeutic misconception. He's very clear about the difference between clinical care and clinical research. And if I were to help the listeners better understand, I would draw a bright line down a piece of paper, and I would say, there on one side, in clinical care, you're a patient, you're dealing with a doctor, it's for an individual with standard of care and therapy. On the other side, for research, it is an investigator, it is research, it is perspective for generalizable knowledge, and if it's randomized, it's for what we call equipoise, and it maintains uncertainty. There is a regulation that if anyone wants to read it, it comes under the Department of Health and Human Services for the Protection of Human Subjects, and it's called Title 45, the Code of Federal Regulations, Part 46, or what we call 45 CFR 46. And then you better understand those differences. We have stopping rules. We have data safety monitoring boards. In other words, long before these trials come out, and they're just willy-nilly trials, there are a group of people from all types of disciplines that sit down and make sure that the investigators come under very stringent guidelines and that human subjects are protected as best we can.
Now, would that be true both for trials that might take place at NIH and also trials that a private drug company might be running?
Well, in the NIH where we are, it's called intramural. In other words, it's in the clinical center. And intramural, because it's in one location, there's that stringency. There's always going to be people out there that you can't vouch for because you really don't know what they're doing. I'm not able to say, and nor would I say, anything about private sector versus certainly the governmental. All I can answer for is what we do at the table when we're at the NIH, and I've done this for 8 years. But it's one of the things we struggle with all the time, and let me get to the compensation. We actually make sure that we toss around how much people should get paid in terms of compensation because for poor people and for people who think this may be their last chance, especially if they're, you know, minority, vulnerable population, et cetera, we want to make sure that the money is not on the table so that they think that they are going to get paid for this sufficient they can pay their rent. Because the element of coercion always exist, and we want to make sure that they're coming with informed consent rather than with coercion or because they're being paid, which is probably one of the reasons that that gentleman, when he was dickering around his $30 or whatever it was for his gas money, it, you know, the idea that he needed, quote, or desired the gas money may have been one of the things that didn't allow him to be in the trial because, he, you know, the need was there, and the person that was conducting the screening may or may not want it, may not have wanted to allow someone in that really needed the gas money that badly.
Mm-hmm. I can see that. Kathleen, thank you so much for your call.
Kathleen,
Alex O'Meara.
Yeah, God bless you, Kathleen. I think everything you say is true, and if every researcher were to draw that line down the piece of paper for every subject, I think the world of clinical trials would be a much clearer and better understood endeavor for those both researching and taking part. But that not most of the time or a lot of the time is not the case. But again, no one, I don't think, gathers information on this. There's sort of an unspoken assumption. I mean, subjects are sitting there. When I was being interviewed, you know, screening, I'm talking to a guy wearing a white lab coat. He's got a stethoscope. He's a doctor. He's also the main researcher, the lead researcher. What am I to think? Well, at first I was like, he's a doctor. He's there to help me. What else would he be doing? That's the assumption that you have. And that is not, it's, I don't think it's fostered in an overt way. It just happens. And when it happens, the benefit to research is understood. It's kind of a, it's more subtler than a wink, wink, nod, nod. But I know in other countries, people I have talked to in Uganda, when I was in Kampala, I talked to a man who was approached by three different United States drug companies to change his HIV medicine to their medication, and they would fix his house. They would pay him money. They gave him a consent form to sign in English when all he spoke was Lugandan. So these things do happen. I mean, I've talked to people who they've happened to. He didn't take the drugs, by the way, because he just said, the drugs I'm on already work. I don't need yours. But so it happens more in foreign places. And again, there's no consistency across boards. I think someone like the NIH or, you know, where I went, the University of Virginia or American University, where we are now, might have different because of there's more public input and other things than a private corporation. And again, corporations can shield themselves. That is not necessarily to say that corporations are bad. They're not. They do great work. They do amazing work. But we just don't know all the nooks and crannies.
Kathleen, thanks so much for offering us your perspective. I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's take another caller. We'll go to Dallas, Texas, and talk to Robert. Robert, you're on the air.
Hello. I actually had a question. My brother did a clinical study based in Austin, and he met a guy, and he actually claimed he was homeless, so my brother offered to let him stay with him. And they knew each other for about 2 weeks, and my brother ended up being murdered by this guy. And we found out later the reason why the guy was homeless is because he had a warrant out for his arrest in Phoenix. And the guy's already still on the run, and this has been a year and a couple months past. And I just wanted to know if there's any kind of regulation on that side, if there's any way to intervene for something like this to prevent it from happening in the future. Do I even have a stance in court to maybe file a lawsuit or something against this corporation?
Well, Robert, we're so sorry to hear about your brothers. Our sympathies to you and your family. How much inquiry is there, or checks are there on the people who are chosen to participate in clinical trials?
By outside authority, you mean?
Or even by the investigators themselves to make sure, for instance, people are who they say they are?
That's up to the individual investigators, the team, the client coordinators, and also to people like Kathleen who work for institutional review boards and are looking at that and how stringently they are looking at that. I'm not really sure there is a specific mechanism to do that kind of thing.
Here's an email from Matt, and he asks, I am aware of participants under-reporting side effects during their clinical trials. They do this to remain in the study for its full term in order to receive their full payment. Otherwise, they only receive a partial payment, or worse, they do not get paid. Did you see any evidence of this in your research?
I've never seen evidence that if you report side effects, you don't get paid. I think they want you to report side effects. That's the point of it being a clinical trial. I know people will sometimes think that they don't want to bring bad news so they can stay in because they're getting treatment or something else. And that, again, is not necessarily anything coming from the researcher or the sponsor of the clinical trial. It's up to people who think they might have to, or they think, wow, I got this great thing for free and I really want to stay in it, so I think I have to do this. And that's the assumption that people make on their own, I think.
You talked about what people should think about before they agree to go into a clinical trial. Your book also has some advice about what to expect if you do go into a clinical trial and it's going on, what do you tell people to be aware of?
Be aware that you should be given a consent form, and it should be explained to you. If you have any questions about it, it should be explained to you. It should be hopefully in the language that you speak and read in. But it should also you should sign that consent form. You should never pay to go into a clinical trial. You should expect to have any question you have answered and taken seriously. You should also expect that you could. Well, I don't want to say expect, but you should ask about whether if something goes wrong, you will be anything that an adverse event is taken care of by the sponsor of the clinical trial. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't, but that's something to ask about.
If you participate in a clinical trial, do you have a right to get the results of the trial?
Not necessarily. You do have the right, however, to drop out at any time with no explanation. It would be nice etiquette if you did give an explanation or told them you were going to drop out. But it's completely driven by the subject, believe it or not. It seems like it's driven by the other side, but the subject are the people at the wheel, which is odd in medicine. But again, this is not medicine, it's experimentation. For patients, subjects, to have that much control and power.
Alex O'Meara's new book is called Chasing Medical Miracles. Thanks so much for being with us this hour on The Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.